Sí, comienza. ¿Cómo no?
Thank you, Shiraz. Thanks for the invitation. And I think I'll start. My name is Pedro Sanchez, for those of you who don't know me, for those of you who do. I had the opportunity to visit Venezuela last month. I was down there for the anniversary of the coup d'etat, the attempted coup d'etat of April of 2002. And I think what I'd like to do is just maybe share a little bit of what I had the privilege of experiencing, of seeing, of sharing some time down there with Venezuelans, many of whom, or the majority of whom, are very involved in one way or another with what people down to refer to as the proceso bolivariano, the Bolivarian process, that certainly is inspired and tied to what the government of Hugo Chavez is doing with the constitutional changes in Venezuela, as well as with many other changes at many levels. One of the things that I know that the film dedicated a lot of its time to is the whole question of the role that the media played during that period of time, that very critical moment in Venezuelan history. For me, it was amazing to actually, you know, you read about the media and the kind of power that it has, and certainly the bias that it has against not only the president, Chavez, but against anything that can be perceived to be tied in any way to Chavez. And that includes, you know, obviously poor people, marginalized people who are being empowered in one way or another by the process. Extremely poisonous. And it was, you know, incredible to watch television every day while I was down there, and see the sort of nonstop nature of the attacks against Chavez, the person, and certainly the process, and like I said, anybody who can be perceived to be benefiting or being empowered by it, and that was just you know, such a contrast to the claims that are made by the opposition, that there is no freedom of expression in Venezuela. You know, I can't imagine, you know, here in Canada we have an extremely biased media that's, you know, held in few corporate hands, that ever there would be a media that was as vehemently and attacking any government. So it was really fascinating to see that. And it was fascinating to see what Venezuelans are doing to sort of, build something that could begin to challenge the power that the media has down there. And one of the projects that I had the benefit of being able to visit and to meet people from something called Katia TV, which is basically a community television project. Katia is a neighborhood in Caracas, which I think the population is about 2.8 million people. You can imagine that's one neighborhood in Caracas. It's a very poor neighborhood. It's a neighborhood that's grown out of slums, like in many centers, urban centers in Latin America. And Katia is, you know, a place where a lot of things are happening as a result of the Chavez government and the implementation of policies and the sort of empowerment that has come through the constitutional change, especially. And I noticed that Maria also brought her constitution, and I brought mine because I was actually reading it a little bit today, just to sort of get a sense again of what makes this document actually quite, so unique, so different from I think any constitution, arguably in history, in the sense that, you know, it recognizes things right from the start. This constitution that, you know, governments and societies have, you know, refused to recognize, you know, histories that have been neglected. History of genocide, for example, is, I think, mentioned in the first 3-4 pages of the constitution. The history of genocide of indigenous people is right in there, and the recognition of that, and a sort of acceptance that this has happened, and this is something that needs to be dealt with today. And, you know, I thought that was extremely fascinating. And you can really see the empowerment sort of transformation that is happening in society with people, with regular people, poor people, people who have been or had been marginalized by decades and decades of a very sort of exclusive way of running Venezuela. Katia TV, was a project that grew out of a sort of a film club in this very poor neighborhood where a group of young people would get together and they would, try to get a hold of films that they thought would be of interest to the community. And they would have a film night every week. And they show films in the sort of, in this community center or even, on a basketball court if the weather was appropriate, any place that they could get. And they did this for years. This is a project that actually began in 1989 in Venezuela. This is at around the time when other things were happening in Venezuela as a response to the very sort of early neoliberal implementation of, what we call the shock, economic shock treatment back in those days. Venezuela was one of the pioneers. The Venezuelan government of Carlos Andrés Pérez was one of the pioneers, certainly in this hemisphere, of implementing these sort of IMF, World Bank prescriptions, with a very brutal hand. Thousands of deaths occurred in 89, in 90, in 92. This, of course, also is connected to the rise of Chávez's rebellion as a member of the armed forces when he attempted a coup d'etat in 92. This film club eventually sort of got a hold of some cameras. And for those of you in the audience who are into documentaries and into film and into sort of different media, it's a fascinating story. They got a hold of a couple of cameras and they eventually decided to film one of the year's most popular sort of cultural events in this neighborhood. And, they went out with their cameras and they filmed, the people singing and people had, become dressed up for this festival every year. And it's a very popular and a very huge thing that happens, especially in the poor neighborhoods. And, with a few cameras, they managed to film this. And then they went into, sort of makeshift editing studio and they created a documentary out of this filming. And, their movie club, their cine club, as they call it, had sort of attracted, maybe several dozen people every week. At best, they might have 100 people for a film night. And suddenly they announced that they were going to show this documentary about how the community itself, could come out and see itself on the screen in this, representation of one of their, most popular festivals in the year. And, they said that, overnight, everything changed. Suddenly they had thousands of people, literally thousands coming out because people wanted to see themselves. This idea that, suddenly this medium of whether it's television or whether it's film is something that was actually, reflecting their reality in a very, in a very direct way, really attracted people to come out. And as a result of this sort of groundbreaking kind of experiment that they launched, this is in the early 90s, they began to actually make more and more productions of their own. And they started actually recruiting and making sort of production teams in the neighborhood. And this is something that now, today, is a television station, which is run entirely by the community of Katia. They have a transformer antenna on top of the manicomio, which is the equivalent of the Queen Street Mental Health Center here. It's, manicomio is a very old word, I think, in Spanish, which basically means insane asylum. And this insane asylum is located in this, this part, the very poor part of Caracas. And on the roof of that hospital, they've put their transformer, and they have their sort of where they broadcast from. And then the National Library has opened up a room for them to do their editing there and to do their recording there. They bring people in to this room and they record interviews with them. And they actually are on air 7 days a week, from 3 p.m. to 9 p.m. In a very direct way, their audience is the people of Katia, the 2.8 million people. And trust me, everybody has a television, even in the poorest neighborhoods. You can see the parabolic antennas outside even the most humble of homes. So, being able to meet some of the people that were involved in this Katia TV and that are still making it grow, the people of Katia TV, in fact, were some of the key players in Katia TV were the people that actually managed to take control of Channel 8 again during the incident that you saw on April 11th and 12th and 13th. And they were instrumental in actually breaking down the sort of blockade that had been put up by the opposition and by some of the metropolitan police, who were anti-Chavistas, because the mayor in Caracas is against Chavez. So because he has control of the police, he was able to stop Channel 8 from broadcasting. These people were very involved in sort of retaking Channel 8. And it was, you know, just fascinating to see some of the work that is being done at a very community level. And, you know, and I think that, you know, speaking to some of the people involved in the project, it was very clear to me that, you know, a lot of this is happening in large account because of the sort of, if not just the orientation in which the government of Chavez sort of presents itself, then certainly because of policies that are directly opening up spaces that people are taking advantage of. You know, one of the things that I heard President Chavez say when I was in Venezuela, and I think it's something that's very, very true, is that often the government feels that, you know, it's moving along in this process at, you know, he used the example at 80 miles an hour. And, you know, and they're moving along and they're trying to build this sort of revolutionary process there. And often the people are going at 100 or 120 miles an hour. And the government is struggling to catch up with the initiatives that people are undertaking in their neighborhoods, in their communities. And Katia Tevez is, I think, a fascinating example because of the role that the media has played and is still playing to this day. You know, it's clear as day to me, being there just a month ago, that the amount of control that the media still has and the ability to you know, to get audience. It's a very modern media. It's a very sophisticated media. It's very, like, sexy in the sort of North American, Western European sense. Whereas the state television channel does suffer from a lot of those sort of stereotypical things that state television channels tend to suffer from, which is kind of a, you know, on the presentation side, a little bit lacking, on the content side, very strong. But I think that when you see something like Katia TV and you see the potential for, you know, projects like Katia TV actually being duplicated at the state channel level, and to actually be able to compete, you know, in terms of getting audience away from the private media towards the state channel or Katia TV or other community broadcasters, and there are many of them. Katia is just one example. There are, I think, three or four community television channels in Caracas alone, not to mention in other parts of the country. And there are radio stations as well. There's such an explosion of publications, for example, magazines, monthlies, weeklies. There's a real, you know, sort of spirited explosion of media, and, you know, media that's been very underground, I think, for many years, that has now found its place, you know, a new space for which to assert itself. So it's very fascinating to see how in terms of in the media field, this is really progressing, I think, quite remarkably. We also had the opportunity to see a documentary, actually, that Katia TV had made during the time of the strike, because, as many of you know, the events that you saw in the documentary tonight, you know, were really, you know, one chapter in the assault or in the attack against the Chavez government. And that in December of 2002 and January of this year, there was, a strike, quote-unquote strike. Really, it was a management lockout by all definitions of what a strike is and what a lockout is. But it was, you know, essentially amounted to an extreme sabotage of the Venezuelan economy by the opposition and by the opposition's allies within, for example, the management of the oil company, which I know Maria is going to talk about, so I won't get too much into that. But, you know, the attacks continued, and that strike was a crippling, you know, act of economic sabotage by the elites, by the opposition, in coalition with the media, which, you know, reduced the output, for example, of oil in Venezuela from 6 million barrels a day to 200,000 barrels a day during the period of the so-called strike. And so, you know, we I can't stress enough how this is still very much an ongoing war in Venezuela, and that the courts, which are still very much in the hands of many of the elites in Venezuela, the Supreme Court and many of the judges and the justices and the prosecutors, it's a system that still very much responds to financial interests in Venezuela, have not yet been able to even charge any of the coup plotters, any of the generals that were involved in this, massive violation of not only the Constitution of Venezuela but international law as well. Not a single person has been indicted, and there's obviously a lot of struggle around that in Venezuela. A lot of controversy, a lot of hurt in people that lost, family during the days of the strike and after, because the deaths certainly have not stopped. One of the things, and I think this, I'll share this with you, and then I'll let Maria so that we have speak, so that we have some time to sort of have interaction with all of you, is a documentary that Katia TV made about what happened in one of the schools, again in the same neighborhood of Katia, during the strike. Because it was the municipality was behind, or in alliance with the strike as well, the opposition, one of the things that happened is that the schools were locked down, literally. Schools were locked during the Christmas holiday when the strike began. And then in January, when it was time for children to go back to school, this actually did not happen. The administrators of the schools did not unlock the doors or the gates to the school. And in the case of one school near Manicomio, near the place where the transformer is for the Katia TV, children came to the school. There were 700 children that were being educated in this municipally controlled public school. And many of the children came to the school on January 6th, I think it was the date of back to school date in January. And they found that the gates to their school were completely locked. And they started, very spontaneously making a lot of noise about it. And in the days to follow, the parents joined in, neighbors joined in, all kinds of people, sort of caught on to this and realized that, they had to make a lot of noise in order for the school even to be open. Even as a space where the children could safely go and, play ball or something, and they wouldn't be on the streets. As many of you know, I'm sure, violence and crime is still one of the biggest problems in Caracas especially. The idea that the community had at that point was, let's at least open the school and let these children have a safe place to be. And after some very embarrassing demonstrations, embarrassing to the municipal government, felt quite compelled to actually open the school. And they sort of bowed down to the pressure. The kids came out the neighbors came out in thousands, and they blockaded entrances to the hospitals and did all kinds of protest actions, and eventually got the door to the school unlocked. But the administration completely kept their hands off. And they ordered all of their teachers, who were officially on strike, not to come back to the school. That this was, had been taken over by the Bolivarian circles, that it was now, basically a training camp for, communist terrorism and all this kind of thing. And there was a lot of very, again, the sort of venom and the poison that was coming through the mainstream media, especially against this community initiative, was very vehement attacks. And one of the things that happened was that, again, Katia TV, the cameras were there. And when the doors were opened, the children and the neighbors entered into the school and the cameras were rolling. And it was fascinating to see this documentary, because one of the things that became very clear was that neighbors, parents of the children that had been going to the school for generations had never really had an opportunity to ever even enter the school grounds. For many people, this is the first time that they were ever walking through these gates. Because the education was such in Venezuela, especially in the public schools and especially in the poor neighborhoods, that there was such a disconnect between the administration or even the teachers and the parents of the kids. This is a place where kids were sort of, taken to the front gate and just sort of, released into the school and then picked up at the end of the day. And once, the cameras started rolling, and once it became evident what the conditions of the school were, the actual physical condition, not to mention just the general condition of the education system there, it was horrifying. I mean, they found out that the tank where the drinking water is held in the school had, the lock, they had to break it with a hammer. It had not been opened for what looked like decades, years anyway. And when they finally opened the tank where the drinking water was, it was a disgusting sight to think that kids were actually drinking, day after day, 700 kids. kids from this water tank. They went into the bathrooms where the kids had to, you know, urinate and use the bathroom. And it was, you know, it was a horrendous sight where there had been no water for years. The toilets did not flush. There was no water in the sinks. You know, the condition of the classrooms, none of the lights worked in the classrooms. None of the fans that had been there to make some fresh air, some circulation, none of them worked. Windows were broken. The library was neglected. The kitchen, which was in the basement, had been completely abandoned apparently 7-8 years previous to this sort of, you know, neighborhood or community occupation or retaking of the school. And, you know, they hadn't fed kids there for like 8 years. And this kitchen, you know, at one point they had decided that it was, you know, unworkable, and they had just locked it and left it alone. So when the community went into the school, they completely, you know, took over the school. And what started happening was that neighbors and people from the community started offering their services. You know, I met actually a couple of the men that had a couple of twins, actually. They're very old. They're probably, you know, they look like they were in their 80s or 90s. The sweetest, you know, two old men that I had ever met. And, you know, they had spent most of their lives in this poor neighborhood kind of fixing radios, fixing portable TVs for people, fixing fans. They were kind of like the handymen of this neighborhood. This is how they made their living. And these guys came into the school and said, whatever needs fixed, we'll fix it. You know, and they became, and they're still to this day, the you know, the two maintenance men of the school, the guys, you know, the guys that fix everything. And they managed to fix everything. And, you know, with community participation, they fixed, they, you know, they cleaned off the desks, they fixed the chairs, they painted them, they put the lights back up, you know, they cleaned out this huge area in the middle of the school, which was literally like a forest. It was, you know, the kids couldn't even get close to this because the vegetation had so overgrown itself, and they cleaned all that out. And, you know, visiting the school now, a month ago when I was there, was such a such an inspiring experience, because you could really see in the face of the children, you know, the sort of health and happiness that they're feeling, and pride. You know, the kitchen, for example, just to give one example, the kitchen was reopened. This school now feeds 650 kids every day lunch. And this was something that, you know, when the school was in the hands of the municipality, this was not happening. Of the 34 teachers that were in that school before the strike started, only 5 of them came back. And I can tell you, those 5 teachers are treated like heroes in that community. I mean, these people are, you know, so courageous and so brave and really seen as heroes, men and women. And the children love them. You can really see it visibly. Of the 34, 29 stayed away. They never came back. And those 29 that stayed away are still being paid to this day by the municipality, their wages. But the 5 that came back have not seen a penny since, you know, this since January, since they came back to do this. So, you know, even more, there's a real sort of, you know, they're seen as examples for the community and for the kids. You have now, you know, university students who are, you know, who are educating themselves in the sciences or in math or in the arts, and they're spending 3-4 hours every day going to the school and teaching kids on a volunteer basis. And this school is now running completely in the hands of the community. And even when I was there in April, it's still like you still once in a while you'll see a TV report or you'll see a newspaper report about this school and about how it's, you know, literally, I mean, they might as well call it, you know, an Al-Qaeda camp, because that's really, you know, the sort of the level of the rhetoric. And, you know, and we laugh about it, and we laughed about many of the things we heard in the documentary tonight, but it's actually quite frightening, because it's very real, and it's, you know, their power of persuasion is really quite frightening. And there's a very, you know, strong system of servitude, in like in many countries in Latin America, of, you know, there's a lot of people who are domestic servants, and people who have alliances and feel loyalties to people in the upper classes who employ them, or whatever the case may be. So it's a very difficult situation, and it's a real war that is happening still to this day. So those are two things that I saw in Venezuela personally that I think you know, really made, you know, inspired me quite a bit, and I think are good sort of examples of things that are happening well below the government level. And I'm sure we can get into talking about the government and Chavez and everything that's going on at that level. But at the level of sort of, you know, people empowerment, there are things that are happening there that are, I think, really quite historical.